This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Retired U.S. Coast Guard Admiral Kerry Thomas was in Honolulu this past week. We talked with her on Friday, which marked International Women's Day, notable because of the strides women have made and because we have so much further to go. Our conversation about women in the military came during a week when Congress heard of a sex assault from one of its members. Senator Martha McSally was a combat fighter pilot and shared a story about being raped by an Air Force superior officer. Admiral Kerry Thomas shared that it is largely through Congress's action that women have been more accepted in leadership roles in our armed forces. Thomas spoke with us as she looked out at the view from Diamond Head. She used to live at the lighthouse as head of District 14, covering the Pacific as far out as Singapore and Japan. She regards that time as the pinnacle of her military career.
It really came about as a result of several things. Access, that is, you know, the laws changing, the Supreme Court cases that allowed for, you know, all women to be able to serve in all parts of the military. You had opportunities where you had men who had never worked with women before who would just give them a chance to learn and to grow and to make mistakes and still keep going up the ladder, getting some education and getting some training along the way, and then, of course, some leadership opportunities. And so as I reflect on my time here in the Pacific, one of the things that I was so privileged to be able to do was to travel around, you know, all through Micronesia and with some of the other international players in the region, from Japan to Guam to American Samoa to France and New Zealand and all. And everyone relies on each other. And it was just such a great opportunity to travel to Papua New Guinea and to in an international women's forum that the U.S. Embassy hosted there, to watch women leaders from the individual villages come together and to learn from one another to try and make their country better, truly was the pinnacle sort of my career.
Now, recently, Senator Martha McSally dropped a bombshell this past week talking about her time in the military and a sexual assault.
Yeah, my heart aches for her and for all women that have been victims of assault and harassment. I would tell you that I am a member of Me Too as well. And while my assault was not nearly as egregious as others were, it was not an easy time growing up in the military for women. But, you know, it was just part of what I would do to try and make it better. And while it hurts me now that women are still, you know, maybe not working quite on an equal playing field with regards to how people feel about them in the military, all senior leaders that I know are completely committed to a full integration and setting the right command climate for women. And there are some amazing leaders that are still, you know, in the military trying to do their very, very best to allow for women to be able to serve and just come to work and be the best member of the military that they can be. You know, I watched a little bit of congressional testimony, and, you know, it really hurt me to see that, you know, here was an 04 in the Navy and an Army, I think she'd been a captain or a lieutenant, who had been assaulted, you know, in just the last few years. Now, I often said that for me, it took me about a full 10 years to find the courage to speak up about when I didn't like something. And the first time I remember doing it, I was a lieutenant. I'd been in the Coast Guard probably about 6 or 7 years at this point as a commissioned officer, and was walking on a Navy base, not in uniform, and somebody whistled at me. And I just had enough at that point. And so I got his name, went back, talked to my boss. We went, you know, to see him and his boss. You know, he apologized and just tried to put it aside. There was another time when I was at the Navy War College up in Newport, Rhode Island, where they were having a Muslim event at the commander's house from a country that exercised the Muslim faith, and in that faith, women were not, you know, really a part of their leadership structure. And so the commander made a decision not to have any women invited to that event that night. And that frosted me pretty much, because while I understand wanting to adhere to cultural norms and try and respect them, part of what we do as Americans in international leadership positions is exercise what it is that our value systems are and to display those so that they can learn from us. And I had many experiences at the APCSS, you know, downtown Honolulu with many international colleagues in which heads of navies that were just beginning to integrate women into their service would ask me, well, what's it like if I have to have women? And what if they cry? And it was just an interesting time and an interesting perspective. You know, all I can say is today that humans are imperfect. The military still needs to keep working this issue, and that part of our desire at Dakowitz, that we look at the widest spectrum of issues that are affecting women in the military so that it's better than it was last year and the year before and the year before that.
Right, so that exclusion shouldn't happen.
Right, yeah.
So any advice that you would give to your daughter or any young upcoming member of our military services?
Yeah, I would encourage them to find a way to feel comfortable speaking up. And I know it is something that my daughter has no issues. If she has a problem with something and someone, she's never been afraid to just call it out, deal with it, and move on. Not everybody's quite that way. One of the things I encourage people is to look out for your neighbor, because while they may not feel comfortable speaking out, that their neighbor may not, they could help speak out on their behalf and to try and see things from their point of view. So part of my advice is to speak up, and if you don't feel comfortable, find somebody to confide in who can then help give you the courage to do better and to report or to at least walk through an issue. Sometimes you view things just through the fact that you're young and naive, and I remember getting in trouble when I was a young cadet at the Coast Guard Academy thinking I was getting picked on because I was a woman. And it had really nothing to do with the fact that it was a woman. It was the fact that I was just being a pretty crummy cadet and having people help me see things is always helpful. So getting good mentors, getting good confidants is an important part of, you know, maturing your way through an organization.
Now, you're with the Coast Guard Mutual Assistance these days, and you still have a hand in helping your service members.
So we're a 501c3 charity. There are military aid societies for all of the branches of the military. So Navy Marine Corps Relief Society, Army Emergency Relief, and Air Force Aid Society, and Coast Guard Mutual Assistance. And so we're all congressionally recognized. And our mission is to provide financial help to members of the military. So when I took this job about a year ago, knew that we would provide people when there was, you know, storms like Hurricane Lane that came through. But we never predicted that members of the military in the United States Coast Guard would not be paid. And so it was a great privilege to be able to help over 6,000 members of the military with over $8 million in assistance during the government shutdown.
Want to share, just reflecting on your time out here in the Pacific and our ability as a community to be prepared, whether it's a natural disaster or something man-made, some other threat?
Well, certainly, much of the infrastructure in many of these islands is right at the sea level. And you can have a few hours preparation for a tsunami, but were one to happen, it would be very, very difficult for much of the infrastructure to quickly recover as a result of that. And so as individuals, you know, it's important to just have some, you know, supplies at home, whether it's just some food, you know, great cans of Spam and rice that's sitting there that can help you through, having flashlights, having batteries, because you don't know what Mother Earth may provide. And while I wanted to be a marine biologist from the very beginning and be about the ocean. And while I love the ocean, it is a very powerful, powerful thing of nature. Mother Earth often decides that, you know, things need to be restored in ways that we don't understand. So, you know, being prepared the best that you can as a family for any kind of, you know, circumstance, whether it's a tsunami or it's a hurricane that comes by, you know, is an important part of being ready as a community member.
That was retired Coast Guard Admiral Kerry Thomas reflecting on her time in the military. She's now based in the D.C. area, serving as executive director of the nonprofit group Coast Guard Mutual Assistance. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're examining the helicopter mechanism on a knife. The inventor, a former Marine, holds over 30 design patents on different items, including locks, lock mechanisms, and knife designs. In 1998, he designed a contract with Kershaw Knives that led to what is today the most essential feature to any good foldable knife. The invention of the speed-safe assisted opening mechanism led to an entirely new factory job creation and an increased demand for Kershaw Knives. The SpeedSafe system allows the user to smoothly open the knife with a manual push on the blade's thumb stud, but its bread and butter, no pun intended, is a revolutionary torsion bar that helps keep the knife closed with no room for an accidental opening. The knife design was so successful, it led to this Kaneohe resident starting his own knife company and the induction into the Blade Magazine Cutlery Hall of Fame in 2008. It made him the youngest living member. Can you tell us who we're talking about? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation supporting the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting four installations for the Honolulu Biennial 2019 through May 5th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Arthritis, it might happen to a lot of us as we get older, but are there things we can do now to help our joints stay healthy? If you do have arthritis, is it safe to exercise? When do injections or even surgeries help? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show when we talk to an expert about the options for arthritis. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Human beings love water. According to the United Nations, 8 of the world's 10 largest cities are located on the coast, and more than 2 billion people worldwide live within 60 miles of a coastline. With more people moving to these urban areas, our cities increasingly interacting with the world's oceans, and not always for the better. Michael Bruno is the Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Hawaii. And before taking that job, he ran the College of Engineering and Science at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. While there, he helped the city of Hoboken prepare for Hurricane Sandy and co-authored The Urban Ocean, The Interaction of Cities and Water. He recently gave a talk on that subject at the East-West Center here in the islands. HPR's Ryan Finnerty caught up with him afterwards.
In the engineering community, when we talk about managing water, we always talk about Holland. And as most people know, much of what constitutes the nation of Holland is below sea level. And over the course of centuries, the nation has learned to live with flooding, learned to divert floodwaters away from critical infrastructure and homes. Sometimes the lack of success of those efforts has led to very serious efforts in terms of land management as well as engineering. So the design and construction of massive ocean barriers, which are in a few cases modern marvels of engineering. Yeah, but the Dutch have no choice. There's no place for them to go. And so they have exported that knowledge to the United States and beyond. There are remedies, I'll call them remedies. They are not permanent, but approaches such as what we call beach nourishment, where one goes to the coast and basically replaces nature, replaces what a natural river would have done after a storm, and that is deliver new sand to the beach. And by doing that, create a wider beach that can then form a buffer against the next storm. In many cases, nature doesn't have the wherewithal any longer to do that, and so man comes in, takes nature's place, and I would say the Dutch have for decades now led the way in that kind of an engineering approach.
And you talked about the consequences of ignoring nature or trying to overpower nature, and specifically you talked about during Hurricane Sandy in the city of Hoboken, New Jersey, there was a lot of flooding along what had previously been a river and had since been paved over. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the field has been and I think needs to do more of learning about what has gone on before us. That goes for here in Hawaii, where we've had populations that lived very sustainably, and I would argue in a very resilient way, for centuries. And it goes for the mainland and other developed areas, where we have only to look back at what existed and what was done in the way of utilizing coastal, particularly property and land, and understand where nature once had a river, where nature once had a bay or an inlet, where there was no sand. And all of these, in my view, are telling because they are saying that the natural balance is what existed in the past. And by us imposing a balance that we are insistent on, whether it's new development or a dam on a river or an altered river in any way, we need to understand that those actions are going to have consequence. And I think the major story there is that very often it is only in that very large, often catastrophic event like a Hurricane Katrina, a Hurricane Sandy, that we really learn, we have the benefit of relearning that lesson.
Also, in Hurricane Sandy, you told another story that, to me, illustrated some of the unintended consequences of human actions, and it took place when a tunnel between Manhattan and Brooklyn flooded. And could you just share that anecdote?
Yeah, it's a story that I don't think was widely known. The Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, which links the lower portion of Manhattan to Brooklyn, filled to the ceiling with ocean water, with water from New York Harbor. It's mind-boggling to think of the volume of water that is required to do that. But soon afterwards, there were a host of different ideas out there put forward by technology developers and other inventors, among which was ways to plug the tunnel and other tunnels like it in the event of a forecast major flooding event, such as happened in Hurricane Sandy. When we talk about unintended consequence, we have only to look at that particular event, because at that moment during Sandy, the World Trade Center was still not complete. And there is consensus among those of us who examined the situation that had the water not been allowed to drain into the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, it would have flooded the World Trade Center construction site. And it kind of boggles the mind what that might have led to in terms of the destruction that would have gone on at the site.
And to me, that illustrates the real need for good communication between scientists like yourself and policymakers who are making the decision whether or not to buy the giant plug for the tunnel. And can you discuss some of the challenges and the consequences of failing to communicate the scientific findings in a clear way that's usable to the regular person out there?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time communicating and talking to the residents and government officials in the run-up to the landfall of Hurricane Sandy, and particularly in the weeks and months that followed. And often I titled those talks Lost in Translation, because we in the science community thought that we were communicating in a clear, concise, accurate, scientific manner when it came to things like the level of flooding that we were going to expect during a storm like Hurricane Sandy. And I think it is very difficult for a person to comprehend the entire ocean rising something like 9 or 10 feet, that entire horizon rising, and then to superimpose on that waves and debris and all the rest that a storm brings. And so you learn very quickly that in terms of your communication skills, you need to start being a lot more vivid in your description of what is going to occur. You find that language then prompts action. For example, instead of saying, well, the storm surge will be 9.5 feet, nobody knows what that means, because simply said, people don't really understand what elevation they are living at or the elevation that their car is parked. You need to translate that information into a form that says, if your home lies in this area or if your car is parked on these streets, you need to move. If you have critical infrastructure lying in these areas, this is what you ought to prepare for. But I think we're learning some hard lessons, in my view, slowly and too slowly, that we in the science community need to work with decision makers and translate that information into actionable information.
You've described climate adaptation or adapting to these new realities as potentially a have or have not issue. What do you mean by that?
I think there are social justice implications for everything we've been discussing here, in the sense that if you look around the world, the communities that most need to adapt to what I think are the inevitable changes already underway are the same communities that are least able to afford it. And by adapt, I mean, you know, create wider beaches or higher dunes, elevate roads and other infrastructure, in some areas move critical infrastructure. Those kinds of adaptation measures are very expensive. Really expensive. Simply elevating a major roadway is very, very expensive. And so I worry about the implications for that. I also worry about the fact that for those communities that cannot adapt, they will need to move. And so where do they move?
So with all that being said, what do you think the world looks like 50 years from now?
I think we could safely say our coastlines will not look the same as they do today. I think that communities like Waikiki, like Miami Beach, Atlantic City, New Jersey, and others where there's enormous investment in coastal oceanfront infrastructure, where in places like here and Miami, you have a very heavy economic dependence on tourism. All of those factors, I think, weigh heavily towards a need to invest continually in adaptation strategies. The question at forefront of my mind is, how fast will this change be? It's happening now. Humans are remarkably adaptable. I used to point out to my classes that you will find us at the equator and you will find us at the pole. And so as a community, we are remarkably adaptable. But when the change happens in a very rapid fashion, and we've seen this in some catastrophic events, we may not be so adaptable. And so I think a lot of the answer to your question resides around how rapid will the change be. If it is slow enough where decision makers, policy makers, and the public can come together on solution paths, then I think there are ways that we can manage the risk and adapt to the changes. I just, again, I go back to, I worry that for many communities, there's just not enough in the way of resources to do that. And this is going to be an ongoing struggle, I think, for the global community.
All right, Dr. Michael Bruno, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Michael Bruno, Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Hawaii and the author of The Urban Ocean, The Interaction of Cities and Water. You can find a link to his book with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nick Gruby may be in D.C., but he's still on top of the ongoing Honolulu police corruption scandal. Morning, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Boy, your story really lays everything out. I mean, you're focused on an accused drug dealer, Tiffany Matsunaga.
Yeah, that's right. So Tiffany Matsunaga's case is sort of at the center of this unfolding scandal that we're seeing. And it was, so she was arrested in 2015 on a series of drug charges. And what we've learned recently is that some of the drugs that were found in her house, according to federal investigators, belonged to Catherine Kealoha's younger brother, Rudolph Puana, and that Catherine Kealoha, who was a city prosecutor at the time, used her official capacity to allegedly cover up the fact that the drugs found in the house belonged to her brother. Now, of course, this case also provides us a window into other aspects of the ongoing federal investigation, which so far has resulted in the indictment of Honolulu's former police chief, Louis Kealoha, as well as Catherine. Four other police officers and guilty pleas for others so far. But it also provides a window into what they might be looking at in relation to Honolulu prosecuting attorney Keith Kaneshiro, who, of course, is also named as a target of this criminal investigation.
Now, your story really looks at these potential conflicts of interest with so many people on so many levels.
Yeah, I mean, I think so it's a really long piece, and I would encourage any of your listeners to go read it, because it is a very complicated web of characters and incidents. But basically, at the center of it is this drug case that appeared to have numerous problems and conflicts from beginning to end, whether it was from the initial raid and the ways in which I learned that Honolulu police officers were omitting important information from their police reports, including the fact that Catherine Kealoha was on the scene and actually orchestrating part of this, to another thing that came out in recent court records, in which it was a Honolulu police officer, Catherine Kealoha's high school boyfriend, in fact, who had sort of tipped her off to this idea that the drugs in this house may actually belong to her brother.
Yeah, I mean, this is, it's really astounding. It's just like, wow, one thing after another, and you're going, what? You really have to sit there and digest this, because you managed to connect the dots over, like, so many years.
Right. I mean, I think what we have to remember is that this is an ongoing federal investigation, and it's an investigation that began several years ago in 2015, and so now it's 2019. And we haven't even had the first trial yet. And I think that we are expecting more charges to come down. Again, Keith Kaneshiro, Honolulu's prosecuting attorney, has been named as a target of this criminal investigation. So has Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell's top civil lawyer, Donna Leong. She's also received a target letter. And so that sort of indicates that federal investigators are going to keep digging.
Yeah, and you even have the problem of the conflict of interest with Miles Briner, the defense attorney. Just really incredible story, just like you said, layer upon layer. Lots of characters in this story.
Yeah, there are a lot of characters. I mean, like I said, from beginning to end, there are a lot of interesting angles and potential conflicts, some of which are more serious than others, including among the lawyers, from defense attorneys to prosecutors, and then including among the police officers themselves.
Yeah, it reads like a novel. Thanks so much, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Catherine.
That was reporter Nick Ruby with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, and boy, it's a humdinger, visit civilbeat.org.
Kani Kapila Sunday is my favorite program because it allows you to discover so much Hawaiian music. There's such great Hawaiian music coming out, and to be able to find out about the artists, listen to the songs, listen to a variety of music is one of the most satisfying ways to spend a Sunday afternoon.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see. This morning, we're going to be talking about eating invasives. HPR's Kuve Hirashi is here. So we're eating alien species?
We are. That is a strategy that is going around, and I've been hearing and seeing these events, usually fundraisers across the state, where you have these top-of-the-line chefs coming in and coming up with some creative concoction using an invasive species. So initially at the back of my head, I mean, I'm from the Big Island, so I'm thinking fire ants, koki, like, are we really eating these? But there are invasive species that have grown and sort of to an unmanageable degree here in Hawaii that are delicious. So think of kalua pig or wild boar, unhoofed ungulates, so deer or venison. These are things that people would eat and there's a market for. So I went to an event over at a Hala'iwa fish pond where they brought in chefs, Mark Noguchi of the Pili Group, Tammy Ho Smith of Hale Ke Aloha, and also Chef Ed Kenny. He's the owner of Town or Mud Hen Water, a number of restaurants in Kaimuki, to talk about this concept and talk about the ingredient that they used for the night. So they were all tasked with using an ingredient, two dishes, different invasive ingredients. So this is Kenny talking about his dish.
It's fun for us, you know. I mean, like tonight we've got haulekoa seeds. They're green haulekoa pods. You know what a menace those are. You know, they always drop the seeds and then they just get forests of haulekoa, right? But it was brought here as cattle fodder. And they found out when they were feeding it to the cattle that there's an enzyme in it that would make the cattle go bald. So it backfired. So now we have this menace of a plant. But it's used in Mexico quite a bit and Thailand for culinary purposes. And it's kind of got this, when you toast the green seeds, it's got this nutty, kind of garlicky flavor.
What are you going to be doing with it then?
We are going to be topping kalo pa'a, just fried kalo, with chili pepper water, mayonnaise, and this on top.
It was delicious.
And that's interesting. You know, he's right about the effect on the cattle and horses, because I worked at a horse ranch, and they said, don't let the horses eat that because their mane will fall out.
Exactly, and it seems to be sort of as we go and as we learn how these plants that come to Hawaii or species, how it affects the natural or the native plants and species in the area, that's when we find out, okay, maybe we need to figure out a solution for this. So he went on to kind of say that, yes, there is commercial potential in some of these recipes that they come up with, but I mean, he doesn't think that it'll entirely wipe out the haulekoa population by making a few of these dishes. And that's essentially the idea I was thinking of. I wanted to know, is this thing going to work? Are we seeing a lot of this? So I remember hearing about, in I think it was Illinois, back in 2012, had actually extracted, so Asian carp is a huge problem in invasive species in the Midwest. They took out about 22,000 metric tons of Asian carp and exported it to China for about $20 billion. So the idea of just getting rid of an invasive species, but also using it, so it's a big, in China they actually do eat it. It is a delicacy. But finding that market was something that I thought that was kind of interesting when it comes to trying to figure out what to do with our invasive species problem in Hawaii. So Hawaii right now, we spend about $60 million on invasive species, and folks who actually work in that arena will say that is not enough. That is, you know, we need another $40 million to really get at managing some of these species.
Right, because if these fish or whatever they are damaging to our environment and they're eating somewhere else, then why don't we ship them out of here if we can?
That and so these strategies are this idea of eating it, I think, has really got more interest because we've also got folks interested in food ethics and local, eating local. And so it kind of hit that that cultural hot spot or sweet spot for us trying to figure out what to do with it. So I got to speak to Josh Atwood. He's the coordinator for the Hawaii Invasive Species Council. And he kind of frames how really complex this problem is when we talk about how we're going to do, how we're going to combat invasive species here in Hawaii.
The problem is really big in scope in that invasive species affect our native ecosystems and our malka forests. And so that's where the production of our fresh water comes from. It also impacts human health because invasive species like mosquitoes can carry diseases like dengue, Zika, chikungunya. It obviously impacts our agriculture from having weeds in our agricultural fields to having, you know, invasive animals eat crops or trample farmland. And so that impacts our ability to feed ourselves, and it makes us rely more on imports. And so it's a really complicated problem.
And he was saying, you know, the whole goal of invasive species work is to identify the threat early and try to get it sort of prevent any sort of infestation where it can grow, because for the most part, a lot of our native species have been here evolving in isolation for over 70 million years. So it's hard to figure out when these competitive species come in, how to keep them from ruining the environment. So
I recall covering a Roy Derby.
Oh, you know,
it was a reef fish. I guess that the fishermen here don't like, but if somebody likes it somewhere else. But I just was so, I guess, struck by this idea that they would actually, you know, go out and say, hey, yeah, let's knock out this population.
It is. I do know Roy. My dad's a fisherman, so I've heard the complaints for years about how it is growing. I think it's the rate of growth, and then the fact that it goes and eats all the food that our other reef fishes need. So this competition aspect of it, it's hard for our native species to continue to fight against Roy.
Yeah, you want to see more uhu.
You
and
do.
That's Roy.
Exactly. And so this idea of eating it, at least at the event itself, was sort of at the back of our minds. These were delicious dishes. These were top-line chefs. We weren't really thinking about, you know, we're contributing to removing invasive species. But there is an educational component that Atwood was saying was probably the best takeaway from events like Eat the Invasive.
For us, the idea of people eating invasive species, it's a great educational tool for people to be aware of invasive species and their impacts. And, you know, we're supportive of people using what's in nature for sustainable uses. So if you have, you know, invasive berries in your yard and they're safe to eat, that's fine, as long as you're not cultivating them. Our main concern is that we don't want people to be spreading invasive species or cultivating them because they become a commodity. So we're happy to have people who want to find uses for the invasive species that are out there, with that caveat that we want them to do it in a way that doesn't make the problem worse.
So, yes, the caveat, right? We want to create, if we want to make this thing marketable, if we want to have haulikoa seed seeds as something that we buy in the stores, if it could become so popular so as to promote people wanting to cultivate it, that's the other side of the game.
Well, I'll put them on my salads as long as my hair doesn't fall out.
That's right. Good point.
All right. Thanks so much, Kuvehi.
Thanks.
We've been talking to Kuvehi Hiraishi about eating invasives. You're listening to The Conversation.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to name the youngest living member of Blade Magazine's Cutlery Hall of Fame. Kaneohe resident Ken Onion received the honor in 2008 for his revolutionary mechanism for foldable knives. Onion's speed-safe assisted opening mechanism was developed for Kershaw knives. The design is simple. A lock bar requiring a manual release on the thumb stud allowed knife owners to be unconcerned that their knives might accidentally open. Since his initial speed-safe design in 1998, Onion has gone on to create 36 designs, all patented, on items including locks, different mechanisms, and overall knife designs. Now, based in Kaneohe, he's now a featured designer for Columbia River Knife and Tool. His work is praised, and his custom-made knives are collected by enthusiasts, including celebrities Nicolas Cage, Pamela Anderson, and Ziggy Marley. Congratulations to our winner, Bill Haley in Honolulu got it right. He also owns 7 Ken Onion knives. This was a very popular quiz with collectors from Kauai and Maui calling in. One happens to be buddies with Ken. Say hi to him for us, would you? And that's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ballet Hawaii, presenting Los Angeles Dance Project, featuring works by founder Benjamin Milipie and by Martha Graham, March 16th at the Blaisdell, ballethawaii.org.
Ma'o Farms on Oahu's leeward side has been hailed as a model for many things, and the latest is research tied to turning genes on and off. It was part of an epigenetics project started by University of Hawaii Associate Professor Alika Manakea. We talked to him as the program was getting off the ground. Now, a year later, early results are showing promise. Participants showed a 60% reduction in diabetes risk.
You know, I think we all had this feeling that we expected significant outcomes, but we didn't think it would be that striking. So it was really encouraging to see and witness as we collected the data that coming out. And I think that although it's still preliminary and we're still working on recruitment and collecting additional data, I think that the sign is it's telling us right now that's really encouraging, the approach that Mao's taking with the Youth Leadership Training Program and how the effects that they experience on the farm actually does have a ripple effect into the community through interacting with the social networks of those interns, the families and friends. And we're actually, you know, by measuring it empirically, we can validate the Ma'o's, you know, observation that the youth not only benefit from a better education, but appear to be healthier, and their family dynamics also improve. It was really encouraging to see that play out over the course of the year.
And the big deal is that you believe you've been able to reduce the risk for diabetes.
Yes, that's one of the major outcomes of the study so far. We've collected data from interns that enrolled in the program a year ago, and looked at the changes in diabetes risk through that period, not only of the interns, but their social networks as well. But among the interns, we found that more than 60% of the participants in Ma'o's Youth Leadership Training Program experienced decreased levels of their individual risk for developing diabetes, which was really quite striking.
And it really does boil down to getting to our young people and then putting in those good habits, because I know in my family, my kids eat healthier than I do.
Yeah, and that's what we're finding is that the social dynamics, the social networks that Ma'o encounters as they're on the farm, but also in their families, with their families and friends, they experience changes in healthy habits. They actually take back some of the materials and resources back to their families, the produce, for example, and also just the recipes and, you know, the types of things that they do with the produce. And it actually gets back into the hands of not only the participants in the farm, but to family members, and they all start to increase this healthier lifestyle.
You know, I have to say, after we did the interview with you more than a year ago, I went to a family party in Nanakuli, and one of my, you know, cousins said, oh, yeah, you know, we didn't buy soda for the party. We bought water instead.
Oh, that's great to know. Yeah, I think it's encouraging to see people changing their health habits and encouraging others to follow the same ways. I mean, I think that it's now, you know, we're realizing that the current sort of health landscape is unsustainable in terms of the incidence of diabetes and other chronic disorders that we experience. And these are fairly preventable disorders. The problem is we have to re-educate ourselves and reintroduce healthier habits, as well as create a structure and an environment around that that can reinforce and enable these healthier habits. And that's exactly what Ma'o is trying to do. And we're witnessing that change, that interns experience, and taking that back home to their families and their friends in their social networks. And they all can experience that benefit.
So you had this then early success, according to the preliminary data. What are the plans for the study then going forward?
Well, we're still midway through the study. We're completing out the first year. There's one more year left that we're continuing to collect data from interns as well as their family members and their friends. So that's another year going forward to see how these changes persist throughout the second year. And we're actually quite motivated to learn more about how the changes happen and what specific aspects of Ma'o's program might be manifesting this decreased reduction in risk for diabetes amongst the interns as well as their social networks. And so, for example, we've already have some indications of the mechanism by which Ma'o's program might be improving health, and that's by sequencing the DNA of bacteria that's isolated from stool samples that we collected from the participants. We observed that after just that 1 year in the program, Ma'o interns experienced increases in a beneficial gut bacteria that's typically seen with a diet high in fiber, such as from leafy greens like kale, which obviously Ma'o produces a lot of. So these healthy bacteria are known to produce what's called short-chain fatty acids that act as anti-inflammatory agents, which we know help restore normal glucose levels. And that's how we think Ma'o's program might be helping to reduce risk for diabetes. And the interesting thing about this is that we also found that this reduced risk translates into dollar savings in healthcare costs associated with diabetes, which we estimate to be around $33,000 just among the Ma'o interns themselves. And when we extrapolate these results to their social networks, because they also experience a benefit, the cost savings is over $120,000 in diabetes care alone. And that's, again, that's just for that 1 year. And generally, I think what's really important is that these results clearly show that community-based organizations like Ma'o can play a pivotal role in the healthcare system by enabling disease prevention, especially in populations suffering from these health disparities. And I think that's how we really can solve the bigger problem of health disparities, not only in Waianae, but throughout the state. So we hope that this one smaller study can lead to a larger impact out in the community at large, and we're hoping to take that next step. Part of it is recognizing and helping community-based programs recognizing that to recognize that their programs, even though they may not be designed specifically to address health, may actually impact it. So we're providing the scientific tools to these community-based organizations to measure that potential impact. And I think that really has a lot of value, not only in changing individuals' perspective on health and well-being and enabling their health and well-being, but those types of efforts, I think, can help the healthcare system in general shift from its current focus on treatment to prevention-oriented approaches, which I think offers a much more sustainable solution to eliminating diseases of health disparities throughout the state. So I think this is, you know, what we call a prototype or a pilot study showing and demonstrating that these community organizations have programs that really do impact health, and to make that more widespread and other programs that we're partnering with currently, as well as with other community-based organizations, showing that these effects can lead to a larger change in the landscape of that environment and increase well-being and health of individuals and populations that need it the most, really helps them to be major players in the healthcare system. And I really do think that that's the next step that we need to take in the study. So that's just, you know, small changes happen at a time. We've only just completed the study a year ago, and we're working on following that up. Ma'o is actually institutionalizing this study in a way. They're continuing to collect data of the type that we introduced to look at how their program is affecting individuals' health, the new interns that are recruited to the farm, as well as that of the social networks around them. Really interesting because I think it caused this excitement in our communities here in Waianae. So the Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center, for example, and others, other community partners have come out to ask if they could use the same tools that we've been developing to look at the impacts of their programs, such as the SNAP program, or to encourage nutrition and to help offset some of the costs for accessing nutritious foods from farmers markets, for example, like the Double Bucks program. They're wondering about how that translates into preventing certain health outcomes and how much that would translate into economic benefits. I think we've been able to, while we're working with Maoyn, focusing on their impacts, I think the general tools that we've been developing over that period can translate to other programs that are looking to see those impacts in the community. So I think that's the encouraging next step that we're taking now with new community partners.
Yeah, change your taste buds, change your life.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Associate Professor Alika Manakea talking about promising early results from an epigenetic study out at Ma'o Farms. It was funded in part by the HMSA Foundation and Kamehameha Schools.
Starting a business is tough enough. Now imagine you're out in the middle of rural Idaho, really rural Idaho.
We've had to replace floors, everything, you name it. So I just let it grow naturally and stayed content in where I was.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, turning a very small town boutique into an international enterprise next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
We've run out of time. We have to go. But up tomorrow, we sit down with HART Executive Director Andrew Robbins. Lots to chat about with recent federal subpoenas and the financial recovery plan now before the Federal Transit Authority. Do you have a question you want to pose? We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.